Every religion, including having no religion, has challenges that come with it. The intricacies of practice, whether or not your religious holidays require you to take leave from work in order to honor them, how available supplies specific to your path are, and a host of other bumps in the road are plenty to manage as is. But along with that entire body of concern, there is an additional layer. What other people think. I'd love to live in a culture where it truly does not matter. But what other people think doesn't just end with the inside of their skulls. Unfortunately, there are very real consequences to the stereotypes that go with different religions. As a Unitarian Universalist pagan, I am most familiar with the issues pagans face. It's gotten better. My funniest stories are now old enough to get driver's licenses, but we do still have some problems. In 2021, a Panera employee in Pennsylvania, just up the road, was asked point blank by the manager and assistant manager what her religion was. They were, yeah, I know, right? That's all the managers in the room. They were all on break. It was a direct question, so she was truthful and she told them she was pagan. The usual conversation about how she was going to hell followed. Most pagans are used to that one, as are the atheists, solidarity friends. However, things turned more serious. Her hours were cut. And when she asked why, she was told she needed to find God before returning to her usual schedule. She was reportedly docked pay for breaks that she did not take. The escalation continued, culminating with her firing, and the lawsuit is still unfolding. That was just 2 years ago. It's an extreme example of how the stereotype that pagans are evil or devil worshippers can cause a lot of harm. The further away we get from the satanic panic of the 1980s and the 90s, some of you are old enough to remember that with me, the less common this particular stereotype is. However, although that one is declining, there are new ones now. I regularly represent paganism in diverse spaces. This means that I've given presentations on our religious needs to chaplains groups at hospitals, writers groups so that they can write pagan characters accurately. And of course, I've talked to Unitarian Universalist congregations like our own. A few years ago, I was offering an overview of paganism to a religious education program at another UU. And after the talk, I opened the floor for questions, as I always do, and one of the adults asked, straight-faced, "Why do pagans only wear black?" Now, as someone who never got over falling in love with the goth aesthetic as a teenager, I was, of course, wearing all black. So my first joking answer was that it's slimming. But that also opened the floor to talk about it more. Somehow the goth aesthetic, which many of you will be familiar with from bands like Depeche Mode and The Cure, got mixed up in the occult references in Halloween, and then the whole thing was given wings by television shows like American Horror Story, and now there seems to be a fairly strong misconception that all pagans wear black and too much eyeliner all the time and tend to be dripping with various occult symbols. And don't get me wrong, it looks super cool, like I love that, and also, it's just not accurate. The truth, of course, is that you can't tell who's pagan by looking. We have no uniformity of dress or adornment. The other stereotype that pagans live with, the other big one that is honestly more harmful, is that our religion is ridiculous or shallow, and that following it is some sort of juvenile phase. I can't begin to tell you how many times I have been told something along the lines of, yes, well, paganism doesn't actually count when discussing religious practice. The understanding that the different belief systems within paganism are followed just as reverently, just as devoutly as mainstream religions just hasn't made it across. And it's usually this latter stereotype that keeps people in what we refer to as the broom closet, privately practicing paganism, but never discussing it outside of very carefully monitored spaces. I've been a religious leader among my own people for many years now, and over that time I've had to be very careful about who appears in photos and articles. The perception of frivolousness can be very harmful to a pagan's career. Similarly to Unitarian Universalism, we have a surprising number of engineers, researchers, scientists in our religion. In this region, we also have a large number of government employees, some of them quite high up the chain. The perception that an engineer practices some sort of ooey-gooey, good vibes, only love and light nonsense can cause real problems, and it is so extreme that some of our researchers who publish peer-reviewed papers use an entirely separate name in the pagan community in order to protect their professional identity and standing. I think one of the saddest things I've seen play out are a few people who left paganism because they couldn't find a good way to reconcile their religious life with their day-to-day life. I can't imagine how it feels to give up a faith that resonates with you and supports you simply because the fear that it could wreck your ability to make money and support your family is overwhelming, or because you can't convince the people who love you that you're not evil. And I've talked to people who feel the pull of pagan beliefs, but feel like the path isn't an option for them because they're not into goth or a spooky aesthetic. We're not the only religion with stereotype problems, of course, and there has been progress. I'm not asked anymore what time the orgy is scheduled to begin. That really happened. But we're not out of the woods or the broom closet yet either. And part of why I've devoted so much of my life to clergy work within paganism is the hope that the next generation will have it a little easier than I did. So I'll keep on explaining that my own preference for black clothing is because I listened to too much Susie and the Banshees as a teenager. And I will continue to work as a bridge in the hope that one day people will understand that my religion is no less vibrant, meaningful, or devoutly practiced simply because it has a different structure than Christianity.
Before I get into my planned remarks, I just want to briefly say thank you to Irene, but also just to brag on CUPS just a little bit. So CUPS is the Covenant of UU Pagans, right? We like to double the U's and everything that we can. And as I think it's pretty clear, we have at least the third biggest CUPS group in the country, which I guess really means we have the third largest CUPS group in the world. I think beyond that, if you go to frederickcups.com and click on the events, or just Google Frederick CUPS, and then click on that events link, I think you'll see, I think if you set aside just like the largest attendance at like Samhain or Yule, I think we easily have the most robust UU pagan offerings literally in the world. It's incredible the amount of regular programming they put on. So if you've ever been a little bit pagan curious, you know, maybe want to peek out of your own broom closet, then maybe go to that events link and just see if there's one of the upcoming events that might particularly resonate with you. I know that New Year's purification ritual is actually really quite meaningful and could be an interesting place to start. Or Yule is, of course, one of the two big, along with Samhain or Halloween. Or Irene, I'm sure would be glad to talk with you further. If you're like, can you tell me a little bit about what I'm getting into? She would be glad to do that. Okay. So part of what I say at the beginning of each Sunday service is that as Unitarian Universalists, we draw wisdom from all the world's traditions, balanced to the insights of modern science. And this morning, I want to invite us to explore five different specific things of what that really means, kind of five case studies. Our current month of December always feels like an auspicious time to explore and talk about all the world's religions, because this season is such an annual confluence of so many major religious holidays: Yule, Christmas, Hanukkah, Kwanzaa, more. As the joke goes, happy Christmas Hanukkwanzaa to all who celebrate. Now, there's probably something in that graphic to offend everyone, so hasten to say, more seriously, in the midst of this multi-faith confluence of holidays, I often take a Sunday to invite us to take a step back and reflect on religion as such. And that's where the balance with modern science part comes in. In light of all that we know here in the 21st century, what does it mean to draw wisdom from all these ancient world religions balanced with the insights of modern science? What happens if we, again, take a step back from being immersed in whatever path or paths are closest to us and ask, what is this human thing called religion anyway? Where did it come from, and what is it about? Part of what we find is that religion is notoriously difficult to define. Each semester, I teach just one course of world religions at Frederick Community College, and I guide students through a list of various definitions of religion at the beginning of the course. For now, I'll limit myself to sharing with you just my own personal favorite definition of religion that comes from my favorite religion scholar, Jeffrey Kripal. I love this nerdy photo of him working with, can you see the lit up Iron Man bust in the background? He serves as the Associate Dean of the Humanities at Rice University in Houston. He's actually quite a big deal. If you're interested in like, what's a religion scholar doing with like comic books in the background? He has a really interesting book called Mutants and Mystics that if you're curious about that. Kripal defines religion as humanity's millennia-long encounter and struggle with the anomalous, the powerful, and the really, really weird stuff that doesn't fit in and doesn't make sense in the sense of rationally. Now, that's not all that religion is about, but it gets to the heart of the firsthand spiritual experiences that often led in the first place to the original creation of many religions. This sermon is inspired by two books. Now, I know, again, this is like a reading test for some of you, pretty small type. Studying Religion, Critiquing Cliches, and it's not very creatively titled sequel, Stereotyping Religion 2. To me, you know, this seems like a huge missed opportunity to call it something like Stereotyping Religion 2, The Revenge of Religion, or, you know, one of my friends said they should have called it Stereotyping Religion 2, Electric Boogaloo. But both volumes are edited by Brad Stoddard and Craig Martin, who are professors of religious study at St. Thomas Aquinas College and McDaniel College, respectively. What I appreciate most about these two books, they're really meant to be undergraduate college Religion 101 textbooks. They emerge out of the lived experience of teaching introductory religion courses to undergraduates year after year and hearing like the same myths come up, you know, that need to be debunked year after year. The chapters are a top 10 list of some of the most common cliches and misconceptions that, again, tend to be repeated by students who have never had a previous course. And what does it mean to, like, not be raised in the religion of your childhood, but to begin to engage in the academic study of religion? We'll only have time for a brief tour of the top 5 stereotypes, but these books explore a total of 20 if this sermon leaves you curious to learn more. They're not the most accessible books of all time, nor are they the least accessible, but anyway, that they are, you know, college freshman textbooks. So a stereotype, I'm sure all of you know, it's a simplified, generalized belief. And these books challenge us that religion is much more nuanced and complicated than most stereotypes allow, and that religious traditions change much more radically over time than most people realize. So let's get into these 5 case studies. The first among many stereotypes is that a good undergraduate Religion 101 will help debunk is that religions are belief systems. Of course, some religions are more or less belief systems, but many religions, especially historically speaking, have not been primarily about belief, and that's where the stereotype becomes the problem. Etymologically, the word religion comes from the Latin word for to be careful or to be mindful. You may have heard it means like ligament, to like bind together. That's wrong. That's just like what people think it means. Like, it's not from religere, it's religere, if any of you are Latin scholars. This root meaning has the connotation of any regular act that you do carefully or mindfully. So it could even be something like, I exercise religiously, I play piano religiously, right? If it's something you do carefully, mindfully, regularly. This background is really helpful for understanding ancient religion, which often centered not on belief, but on the careful performance of ritual obligation. In contrast, it's really this modern Western sense of religion that's all about like intellectual assent, like what do you believe, or this kind of inner sentiment of faith. That's sometimes spoofed as you're needing to believe 20 impossible things before breakfast. So from the perspective of religious studies, the problem arises when someone assumes that all of religion around the world and across time is similar to the specific flavor of religion that you just happen to be born into. Undergraduates say things like this all the time in religion courses, and this is certainly, I believed all these things growing up Southern Baptist. I thought all these stereotypes were true. They say, or religion is a set of beliefs, or religion is about what you really believe, or, you know, so indeed, I remember teaching a religion course a few years ago. This was an adult religion course, and week after week, one student in particular, he just, like, every time I asked for questions, he would be like, so I just don't understand how there can be a, how it can be a religion if you don't require a belief in God. He just asked me that week after week, and I gave him the same answers and or different variations, and he just couldn't grok it. He was just stuck in the stereotype that religion equals belief, despite many examples to the contrary. So this idea that religion is primarily about an individual's private beliefs, that arose about 500 years ago in the Protestant Reformation. Many of the Protestant reformers emphasized the importance of sincerely held religious beliefs, and they were really responding to the centrality of ritual in Roman Catholicism that was dominant at the time, and the centrality of ritual in paganism, which was dominant before that. So they were just sort of overreacting and overcorrecting to that. A lot of varieties of Judaism, of Hinduism, of Buddhism, and many other religions are much less about believing things than they are about rituals and behaviors, what you do. An orthopraxy, not an orthodoxy, if you know those words. Many people who are immersed in the stereotype that religions are primarily about beliefs often want to ask you use, what do you use believe? Has anybody been asked that? Yeah, I get asked it a lot. It's a hazard of the job. Well, it turns out what you use believe is that asking what you use believe is not a helpful question. or it's certainly not the most helpful starting point. As the saying goes, we believe in deeds, not creeds. We believe that you don't have to believe alike to love alike. We're about right relationship. Not about believing in common. Now, we're not relativists. We don't believe that just anything goes, but we are pluralists who think that there's more than one legitimate way to be religious. So an orthodoxy, an orthodontist, orthodonte, straightens your teeth, orthodonte, so orthodoxy, did any of you grow up singing the doxology? So doxologos, that means praise words. So orthodox means straightening your praise. So an Orthodox tradition wants you to say and believe the right things. It sometimes say Orthodox traditions are about believe, behave, belong. Believe the right things, then we'll and behave in the right way, and then we'll let you belong. Believe, behave, belong. We're really a polypraxy, like more than one way of doing things, and it switches it. We say belong. Just come and belong. And then you may find that you kind of behave a little differently, ethically, because of you learning some things. And then maybe even in the end, you find yourself believing stuff, stumbling backward into that. So that's sort of the difference. A lot more to say about that, but let's go to the second one. A second stereotype is that the best way to study the world's religions is to compare the similarities. And it typically has a bias toward the religion that person is most familiar with. We'll start with my religion, and then we'll look for all the ways that the other religions are similar to it. A classic example is a list. You may have seen this in various forms, which makes the case that all the world's religions teach compassion. Well, sure, you can cherry-pick passages from all the world's religions that show that they teach compassion. And honestly, that sounds great to me. I'm pro-compassion. But here's the thing. The world's religions are these huge, diverse movements that have changed radically over time. You can also cherry-pick passages from every single world religion showing how it promotes violence. Either way is a simplistic stereotype. So this view is sometimes called the world religions paradigm, and as someone who teaches a course in world religions regularly, I can attest that it is rampant. People sign up for an undergraduate world religions course for two reasons. I know this because they tell me. Their first discussion board is, why did you sign up for this course? They say, it is the most interesting course on the list of general ed requirements. that's the number one reason people take a world religion course. Second, they say that they want and respect that they're going to expect that they're going to study each of the world religions in turn. And I will confess, I disappoint them every time. We do some of that, of course, but by the end of the course, I think I convince most of them that we've been on a journey that is much more interesting and important than the one they thought they were signing up for. One much more important than just studying Hinduism one week and Buddhism the next and Judaism the week after that and then Christianity, then Islam, and then paganism, da-da-da-da-da-da-da. If that's what you want, honestly, just go read a Wikipedia article. Like, you don't need me for that. It's just data-oriented and it's boring. So here's what we do instead. Over the course of 12 weeks, we work our way through a textbook called Comparing Religions, Coming to Terms. It's, again, by that religion scholar I mentioned earlier, Jeffrey Kripal. The first three chapters equip students with tools and terminology and frameworks for the academic study of religion and help them not only compare similarities from the world's religions, but also the differences not only between the religions, but the differences within each religious tradition. If you'll notice the kind of scary mutant eyes on the right, that symbolizes, you know, coming to see differently and to read texts that you thought you knew what they meant, and you come to see that they're actually much more interesting and varied than you thought. I used to teach Intro to Hebrew Bible at the University of Louisiana Monroe, and the most interesting thing I did was get all these kids who had been raised reading the Bible, and they'd be like, whoa, that's been in the Bible the whole time? That's essentially the whole course was like pointing out stuff in the Bible they'd never noticed before. That's just right there in the text that every, like, Gideon puts in every hotel room. If you actually read it, there's some wild stuff in there. That's another sermon. So instead of studying each religion in turn in a siloed way, we spend the middle 6 weeks comparing and contrasting the world's religions through six lenses: myth and ritual, nature and science, sex and bodies, charisma and social dimensions, imagination and the paranormal, and soul, salvation, and the end of all things. And so finally, having taken apart all the world's religions through these different lenses and the whole idea of religion itself, we spend the final three chapters. What are three ways you can then put it all back together again? The first is to become a faithful rereader. If you think back to that mutant picture with the eyes, you can be a faithful rereader in which you continue to privilege one religious tradition. That's a fine option. It's not my favorite, but it's a fine option. You can be a rational rereader in which you privilege what can be known through reason and science, or you can be a reflexive rereader, which takes seriously both the rational critiques of religion and those strange, spooky, uncanny spiritual experiences that you may only know in your own firsthand experiences. So it's kind of both and. One of the final paper questions is for them to choose which of those three types they identify with and to say why, using terms and terminology from the course. So all this is to say that learning to skillfully negotiate both sameness and difference in the world's religions is a lot more complex and interesting than only studying the similarities or studying religions in isolation from one another. The third stereotype is, I'm spiritual but not religious. On the one hand, not that there's anything wrong with that. Approximately 22% of U.S. citizens identify as SBNR, spiritual but not religious. On the other hand, far too many people think that they are limited to being either spiritual or religious, and never the twain shall meet. As the old adage says, religion is for people who are afraid of hell, and spirituality is for people who have been through hell. At least in my view, being spiritual but not religious is a marked improvement on being religious but not spiritual, which often ends in this kind of unquestioning support of some institutionalized religion that's usually quite dogmatic. If we take a step back, however, a lot of developmental theory boils down to this: a three-stage process of dependence, independence, and freely chosen interdependence. That's what we just did earlier, right? Freely chosen interdependence of free individuals. Religious, but not spiritual, is the dependence earliest stage of believing or doing whatever the religion of your childhood tells you to. Spiritual, but not religious, is the independent stage of looking at your own firsthand experience and seeing, what do I believe? What do I want to do? And experimenting. But here's the part that a lot of folks miss. Staying too long at the stage of spiritual but not religious can lead to an arrested development. One's self-made spirituality can devolve into an unhealthy narcissism of entitlement and self-involvement. Even more importantly, a prolonged fixation on independence can inhibit you from doing the hard work of building diverse community and supporting yourself in community. It is not isolated, independent individuals. It is communities of people working together in coalition across differences who are our only hope of building the diverse, multicultural, beloved communities that we dream about. Unitarian Universalism, as well as many other progressive religious movements, they are places where you can move into a third stage of interdependence, being both spiritual and religious. You retain all the freedom to experiment with spirituality while having the institutional support of open-minded religion. You don't have to go through the spiritual journey alone. Indeed, I would argue you can only go so far alone. As one of the religious traditions I'm most familiar with, Buddhism, puts it, and there are parallels in many other religious traditions, you eventually come to realize, a little bit paradoxically, that enlightenment is a team sport. There's a lot to say about that. I promise you it is true. Enlightenment is a team sport. Interdependence is the way. The fourth stereotype is that religious liberty is about religious liberty. What that means is that many people, most troublingly at the moment, many conservative Supreme Court justices, often make the argument that about religious freedom, that religious freedom is just that. We're just enforcing religious liberty. But it's vital to notice the what and the who. The what is what does and doesn't get to count as religious liberty, and the who is who does and doesn't get to claim religious liberty as protection for their beliefs and actions. When major decisions are made, pay attention to who decides and who benefits, and if you're not at the table, you might end up on the menu. And at the table at the Supreme Court means whoever has 5 votes. I've spoken about the constitutional history of the First Amendment at great length in the past. If you look up Constitution in our topical sermon archive on our website, you can find that. What it boils down to is this. At the moment, there is a growing trend of using First Amendment religious freedom. It's claimed to be in this allegedly neutral way, and the reality is there's a strong bias toward privileging the religious liberty of theologically conservative Christians over the religious liberty of other groups, including liberal Christians. That's that diversity within a religious tradition. Inflicting one's religious bigotry upon others in the public square in the name of religious liberty is a dangerous abuse of the Constitution. Instead, we need basic public accommodation. We, the people, are equal under the law in a multicultural civil society and should not be legally allowed to discriminate against one another in protected characteristics such as gender, race, religion, sexual orientation, etc. Religious folks, including we UUs, we're free to lobby the government based on our conscience and our religious values, but the government itself should remain neutral, neither aiding nor opposing religion. A fifth stereotype is that, and the final one, is that each religion has an authentic, unchanging core. But if you explore the history of any religion, you will find deep diversity and breathtaking change over time. As I noted earlier, students often sign up for world religion classes expecting to study the differences between religions, but an equally valuable task is to notice the diversity within each of the religions. For instance, progressive Christians, Reformed Jews, and liberal Muslims have much more essential values in common than any of them do with the more conservative members of their own religious traditions. Really in general. That's diversity within a religious tradition. There's never been one monolithic Christianity. There have always been Christianities, plural. One can likewise break down all the competing Hinduisms and Buddhisms and Islams and paganisms and more. And if we turn back the clock, we find that at the very beginning of all the world's religions, there is already diversity, there is already messiness, and there is already competition over power and control and who gets to determine which of the various meanings and interpretations prevail. Now, as I move toward my conclusion, there's just one more important point. There's a really important stumbling block in bringing up stereotypes, because the way our brains work, the risk is you're going to remember the stereotypes and not the debunking. So that's why I added the strike-throughs. But to reinforce the positive, I'm just going to end with a very quick review. In the broad history of religions, behavior and rituals have often been much more important than beliefs. And to me, that's actually a good thing, because behavior is believable, much more so than what people say they believe. Skillful comparison of religion needs to include attention to differences within and between religions at least as much as it does to similarities. 3. You can be spiritual and religious, or anywhere in between. It's not an either-or choice. 4, genuine religious liberty for all requires that the government remain neutral, neither aiding nor opposing religion. And finally, religions include a diversity of views from the beginning, and religious traditions change significantly over time. Whoever tells you otherwise is selling you propaganda, orthodox propaganda, and dogma. I'll conclude for now with the final lesson that I give to my world religion undergraduates at the end of each semester. My hope is that they have come to see that there is, again, a tremendous diversity, not only between the world's religions, but within each religious tradition. And because there is all of that diversity, we each individually and collectively have consequential choices to make in how we are religious. In the words of the interfaith activist Eboo Patel, that means we are responsible for whether our individual choices create bubbles, barriers, bombs, or bridges. Bubbles and barriers are religious choices that either keep us in isolated bubbles or that build barriers to keep others out. Bombs are religious choices that seek to destroy the religious other. And bridges are religious choices that seek to make connections and to create diverse, multicultural, beloved communities. In this holiday season, I'm grateful to be on a bridge-building journey with all of you. It's not always easy. It's not always easy to be in a big, diverse tent of Unitarian Universalism. But ultimately, I'm grateful for it. So we hold all this in our heart. I invite you to rise, embody our spirit. Let's sing together hymn 298. We'll sing all 5 verses. Wake now, my senses.